Colossians 1 and verse 15. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross.
Great. Thank you, Sam, and good morning, everybody. Good to be with you. A few of you will have arrived this morning, I guess. Who wasn't here last night? Oh, loads. Yeah, back row. Okay. Sneaking in late. All right. So if we haven't met, I'm Glenn, and I'm married to Emma, and we live in Eastbourne with Ruby, who's a few doors down that way. And we go to All Souls Eastbourne. I was the curate at All Souls Eastbourne. I'd like to be known as the curate emeritus at All Souls Eastbourne, but the title is not catching on. So I'm not on staff there, but my day job is as an evangelist, and I go around and shoot my mouth off about Jesus. So that's my job, and we're going to think together, really, about how we can overflow with the good news of Jesus. We're going to look at a verse in a second from Matthew 12, where Jesus says, "From the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks." So this weekend is not about bashing you around the head with a bit of encouragement to evangelize. This weekend, I hope to equip you and give you some sentences up your sleeve and ways into a conversation. But largely what we want to do is fill our hearts with Jesus that we might overflow to work colleagues and friends and neighbors and that sort of thing. You'll notice there are some quite detailed handouts. I always give very detailed handouts and then refer to about 10% of them. So that gives you plenty of space to doodle on them and write whatever you want. And I don't think I'll try to cram everything into every session. If we finish the material early, we might have a peek into the next session, or if we don't quite get to the end of the session, that's okay. We can pick it up next time we meet. But you'll see the first thing we've got there is 3, 2, 1, go, from the overflow of the heart. And that's picking up on that verse from Matthew 12, verse 34, from the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. To begin with, a little exercise. I've just described myself as an evangelist, and I saw many of you just visibly flinch at that. What are the thoughts that come to mind? What are the word associations? What are the images that pop into your head when you hear the word evangelist? What do you think of? John the Baptist. Wild and woolly preacher, kind of on the fringes of things. A voice in the wilderness. Yes, okay. What else? Street preacher. Voice in the wilderness. Yes, street preacher. Big beard. Megaphone. Why be a sinner when you can be a winner? Yeah.
Billy Graham suit.
A suit? Mm-hmm. Is that important, the suit?
That's Billy Graham.
Yes, yeah. I don't think I've ever asked this question and not at some point had the answer, Billy Graham. Yeah, absolutely. Billy Graham.
Salesman.
Salesman. If you were thinking of an individual, what gender were they? Yeah, they were, weren't they? that's unfortunate, isn't it? Or maybe some of you are thinking, oh, well, that's not me then. So a man, wild and woolly, voice in the wilderness, maybe big stadiums, and a salesperson, yes, someone with the patter, they've got the gift of the gab. They could sell ice to the Eskimos, but they happen to be selling Jesus. They could get you to sign your life away with an insurance contract or something, but instead they get you to sign your life away to Jesus. It's a salesperson. Right. Who's attracted to this individual? One hopes. Mrs. Graham, and that's about it. Yeah. Okay, let's do another exercise. You'll see in the next door box, describe an evangelist. Then next door to it, describe someone who led you to Christ. I want you to think now, somebody who was significant in you trusting in Jesus. And you think, but there were 12 people. Okay, pick one. Pick one person who was significant in you being the Christian that you are today. And turn to your neighbor, and I want you to describe them to your neighbor for about 90 seconds, and then they can describe their person to you for about 90 seconds. Should we do that? Let's describe that kind of evangelist. Let's go. Okay, swap over if you haven't already. Swap over. Hopefully we've generated a bunch of different adjectives, perhaps. I don't know. What are some of the descriptive words we'd use about this person? Persistent. Were you a tough nut to crack, were you? Yeah. Hospitable. Yeah. Relatable. They were human. They were kind of, yeah. Yeah. Betty. The life they lived. What was it that struck you about the life that they lived? So different because it was... Yeah. It was towards God, and it was evidently, tangibly towards God, and you could sense that about the person. Who were they, a man or a woman? Or a woman? Yeah. How old were you? You were 18, and they were... Same age. Wow. Okay, a female friend who had a Godward life. Wow. What else? Quite normal. Are they in the room this morning? Very ordinary. Extremely plain. Yeah. Normal. Yes, we've had normal twice now. That's... Enthusiasm for Jesus. That's infectious, isn't it? How do they communicate that? Yeah. But therefore it's quite organic, isn't it? You know, they're enthusiastic about Saracens and they're enthusiastic about Jesus, and yeah. Super astounding, really seriously. Obviously Yeah. Direct. Can you remember a direct moment with them? Who said that? Was you? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And the point was, you need to get real about Jesus, or you need to come to church, or you need to... Right. Wow. Wow. A prayer warrior. How did you know they were a prayer warrior? Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah.
Loving.
How did they show that? Yeah. 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 Brilliant.
Full of peace and full of joy.
Mm-hmm. Did we hear that? Full of peace, full of joy. I wonder what she had. Yeah. Wow. These people who we've just been describing, they're good evangelists, aren't they? Because look at you all. Right? They're sensational evangelists. They've done a brilliant job with you. And some of them are real enthusiasts and direct and to the point, and some of them are warm and loving and patient, and for some it's the directness and for some it's the hospitality, but real and relatable and human, and not a caricature, right? And it seems to me it takes all kinds of people to reach all kinds of people. And, you know, I'm very glad that there is a role for an evangelist with a capital E who gets up and shoots their mouth off and they don't seem to mind that. I'm glad there's a role for that because that keeps me in a job, but I'm not going to be able to reach your friends the way that you can reach your friends. It takes every single one of us to reach the world, and God has wired you in the way that you are in order to be a witness. Maybe not as a capital E evangelist, but as a witness to Christ on your course or down your streets or in your family or at work. He's wired you the way he's wired you for a reason. And you might think, I am not the motor mouth, therefore I could never be a witness. That would be a mistake, wouldn't it? Because think of all the different kinds of people we've just described that reach the world. So maybe, therefore, you and I all have a role to play in witnessing to Christ. Do you think we all have a role? I think we do. And maybe, actually, if you are more of an introvert, let's say, maybe that is a real evangelistic gain. Maybe God knew what he was doing when he made you an introvert. Because maybe your introvert friends would never in their life talk to someone like me. But they might talk to you, right? They might relate to you on your level in the way that you like to relate. So God has wired you the way he's wired you for a reason, and he's placed you where he's placed you for a reason. I wasn't going to go there, but in Acts chapter 17, do you remember that bit where Paul says, from one man God made every race of men, and he determined the exact times and places where we should live. He did this so that men would reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. So Acts 17, around about verse 25. Paul says, you are in the geographical location where you are for a reason, so that men will find God, though he's not far from each one of us. So you're in the place that you are, you've been wired the way that you are, and God knows what he's doing. He has a great mission to the world, to spread the fame of Jesus, and you are a part of that. And you think, oh no, I'm just stuck away doing my little job, and I'm not wired to be an evangelist. And I would say, no, God knows what he's doing. And he is spreading the fame of Jesus, and he is discipling the nations, and you and I, we all have a role. But I think we've got a lot invested in having a caricature of the evangelist. We've got a lot invested. Evangelists like me have a lot invested in it, because we quite like being, you know, put on a pedestal and being different, because we're weird like that. We don't mind being different. And then everyone else doesn't mind putting the evangelists into a special box, because then we wash our hands of the whole caper and we can run along and do our own thing. But I think it's really important that we all take seriously that Jesus knows who we are, has wired us the way he's wired us, has put us where he's put us, because we all have a role in this work called witness. I've got down here the scariest verse about evangelism. Do you want to know the scariest verse about evangelism? Why don't you turn to it? Matthew chapter 23, verse 15. And as you turn to Matthew 23, answer this question: does the world need more evangelists? Does the world need more evangelists? And I want to say that depends. That depends. Matthew 23, just verse 15, you'll know that Jesus is halfway through this big tirade against the scribes and the Pharisees. And he says, verse 15, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel across sea and land to make a single proselyte, a single convert. And when he becomes a convert, a proselyte, you make him twice as much a child of hell as yourselves." Does the world need more evangelists? That depends, doesn't it? It kind of depends on the evangel, the good news that they're sharing. You'll know if you're into coding at all, garbage in, garbage out, right? If you put a whole bunch of garbage into a system, all you'll ever get is garbage out. We'll have a garbage gospel in their hearts. They're only ever going to overflow with garbage evangelism. And they're only ever going to multiply their own error. Now, none of us are scribes and Pharisees in that sense. None of us have made a hash of it to that degree, I hope. But I think there is a sense in which the degree to which you have a garbage gospel is the degree to which you'll do garbage evangelism. And I, as a capital E evangelist, I'm always sort of swinging between two poles. And the two poles are this. On the one hand, I just think, let's just get out there. Come on, let's door knock the parish. Let's just talk to people in the shopping center. Let's just spread the gospel far and wide. Come on, who's with me? And usually only a few people raise their hands at that point. And I go out two by two with these people. And so I have an opportunity to be shoulder to shoulder with a brother or a sister as they're sort of evangelizing. And we'll get to the doorstep and they'll start to explain the gospel as they see it to this unsuspecting non-Christian. And at that point, I'm thinking, everybody back to the classroom. Everybody back to the classroom. Pull out, abort mission. Because so often the stuff that comes out of people's mouths is ugly and false and defames Jesus and is quite often blatant heresy. And so I'm always swinging between these two poles of let's just get out there and do it, and the other pole of okay, let's actually learn the gospel. Let's actually make sure that it's not garbage in, garbage out. Let's make sure it is true evangelism. Matthew 12, verse 34. We keep on referring to it. Matthew 12, verse 34. Again, he's talking to these scribes and Pharisees types. And he says, "You brood of vipers, how can you speak good when you are evil? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks." Now that's interesting because Jesus is saying we are already an evangelist. You were saying your friend was an enthusiast, and he was an enthusiast about all sorts of things and Jesus. And Jesus is saying, yeah, that's the way humanity is wired. From the overflow of the heart, from the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. All of us are enthusiastic about something, I hope. You know, whether it's the new gadget that you just got, you just upgraded your mobile phone, or you know, your team just won on the weekend, or you got the new outfit 70% off in the sale. 70% off? Yes, 70%. Oh, what? Or the grandkids. Have you seen my grandkids? Let me show you the 17th photo. And, you know, we're all evangelists about something. And it always strikes me that, you know, I do the door knocking thing, and I do the let's get into conversation with people in the shopping precinct thing on a Saturday. And quite often we'll go out on a Saturday and there'll be a bunch of us and we'll get into a conversation or half a dozen conversations. Just in the course of 1 hour, I'll go out and I'll talk to a complete stranger. I'll talk to a half dozen complete strangers and have a really good conversation about Jesus. And then I'll go to church on the Sunday, and I'll be among God's people, and we'll just talk about the weather and the cricket and the football. What's going on there? That's really scary if verse 34 is correct, right? If out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaks, what is really uppermost in my affections? What is really firing me? If I'm an enthusiast for a whole bunch of stuff, but I'm not an enthusiast for Jesus, then my problem is not that I need to learn a few more tips and techniques about how to, you know, turn a conversation towards spiritual matters. It's a much deeper issue, isn't it? If what's coming out of the mouth has nothing to do with Jesus, it's a heart problem. It's not a technique problem. It can't be solved just by a couple of tips on a weekend. There's a heart issue. And that's why we go back to basics. Let's turn over the page. We go back to basics, and we... Okay. Unless he is firing us, then... You know, I used to work for a church in central London that had two different things going on a Thursday night. One of them was a theology course that really got to grips with doctrine of God and doctrine of Christ and doctrine of creation and doctrine of humanity and a really rich systematic theology course on a Thursday night. And then on the Thursday night, there was also a group that went out to Oxford Street and just sought to get into conversations with shoppers and teach them about Jesus. And me being wired the way that I am, I went for the latter, right? I went out onto Oxford Street and I sort of tried to engage people in conversation. And a friend of mine sort of joined us just for one Thursday night, and he heard the sorts of things that I was saying on the streets. And he said, "Glenn, you know, there's this other thing that we do on a Thursday night. Really think it might be helpful for you to, you know, just hear a bit more gospel." And I still remember saying to him, "I don't need to hear the gospel. I know the gospel. It's those guys. They don't know the gospel. So I'll stay here and teach them the gospel." And my friend was so bold as to say, "Glenn, you might not know the gospel the way you think you do. Why don't you just take a term out and go to this other course?" And so I did, and I went to this other course, and it blew my mind. And I realized that what he said was true. I did know the gospel, and I didn't. Right? And it's true today. I do know the gospel and I don't. It's true for everyone in this room. We do know Jesus, and my goodness, we could know him a whole lot better. And then I looked back at so much of the evangelism that I was doing, and sometimes I was offering the bread of life, and sometimes I was offering people sawdust that was just, you know, layered with chili sauce to give it a bit of kick, right? That was my evangelism. Sometimes bread, sometimes sawdust with chili sauce, right? And I think what we want to do is get back to basics, go back to Jesus, and let's make sure that we are offering the bread of life. We had that wonderful reading from Colossians chapter 1. Let's go back to Colossians chapter 1. Because if we're going to go back to basics, then we need to start with God. But here's the big question for all our evangelism. The big question is, which God, right? Which God are we talking about when we go back to God? As an evangelist, I speak to a lot of different people. I do a lot of student evangelism, so I'm always speaking to younger people. I live in Eastbourne, so I'm also speaking to older people. It's just the nature of the case. If you don't know Eastbourne, it's one of the retirement capitals of the UK. You know, all the shopfront windows are bifocal, just to help. So sometimes I'm speaking to under 25s, and sometimes I'm speaking to over 65s, and I've developed a couple of rules of thumb. And if I'm speaking to someone over 65 and they tell me that they're a Christian, I don't believe them, because I live in Eastbourne, right? I'm not rude about it. I don't sort of poke them in the chest and say, "Prove your Christianity, you know, sing Shine Jesus Shine now." I don't I'm not rude about it, but it's just there's a voice in the back of my head, and the voice in the back of my head is saying, 65 years ago, it was much easier to look at a shelf full of labels and pick out the Christian label and put it on and go out into the world. And it helped you to navigate the world frictionlessly if you're a Christian. And if anyone asked you, "Why are you a Christian?" you'd say, "Well, I'm English, so obviously." You know, there is such a thing as nominal Christianity, isn't there? We all recognize there's such a thing as nominal Christianity, and there's such a thing as heartfelt, over 65, you know, spiritual dynamo Christianity as well. There's that. But we recognize that there's such a thing as nominal Christianity. So if someone is over 65, they tell me they're a Christian, I don't believe them. But if someone is under 25 and they tell me they're an atheist, I don't believe them. Not for a minute. Why would you? Do you think your friend who calls himself an atheist, you know, we've all got that one friend who, you know, has read Bertrand Russell and Richard Dawkins and, they are iron for the new atheism. Sure, we've all got that friend. But by and large, when your friend says they're an atheist, do you think they've done 5 minutes of metaphysical thinking about the subject? Do you think they've looked into ontological materialism? Do you think they are a reductive physicalist because they've looked into all the options in neuroscience and just, what? Your friend who says that they're an atheist is just like that person over 65 who says they're a Christian. And what you should be doing is just thinking, yeah, maybe. Maybe they've thought about stuff and made a heartfelt decision. And maybe it's just a label that they slap on and it helps them to navigate the world, a very secular world, in a frictionless way, right? There is such a thing as nominal atheism, right? There is such a thing as being a nominal nun, right? N-O-N-E, the nuns who on the census form say that they have no, when they ask, do you have a religion? They say none, right? There's such a thing as a nominal nun or a nominun. But, there is such a thing. And the question to both, whether they say they're a Christian, whether they say they're a Muslim, a Buddhist, a Hindu, an atheist, an agnostic, whatever they say, the big question is not, do you believe in God, right? The question is, which God do you believe in? Which God do you believe in? Do you ever ask that question when someone says they don't believe in God? We tend to think that that's the end of the conversation, don't we? Oh no, they're an atheist. They don't even believe in God. And we think to ourselves, oh no, they don't even believe in God. So first, I've got to get them over the God hurdle. And what were those 5 arguments that Thomas Aquinas once came up with? And we reach into the back of our brains for some half-remembered philosophical argument. Or, we've got to get them over the God hurdle. And then, having established who God is, we can then maybe get them over the Jesus hurdle and convince them that Jesus is the God that we just philosophically proved to them. That tends to be the way we think. And we think if someone doesn't even believe in God, we're doubly snookered. Oh no! We've got double the work to do. And Colossians 1:15 says we've got it utterly backwards, right? He, speaking of the Son, Christ, he is the image of the invisible God. And this utterly reverses everything in our thinking. Like, we think the concept of God is obvious, right? We think when you say God, it's obvious what you mean by it, right? We think that's obvious. And we think Jesus, oh, who knows who Jesus is? Maybe he's the Son of God, maybe he's a prophet, maybe he was a guru, maybe he's just a nice guy, maybe he's a myth. Who knows about Jesus? But we all know what we're talking about when we talk about God. Isn't that the assumption? Whether you're inside the church or outside the church, we tend to assume God is obvious and Jesus is uncertain. And what does Paul say here in verse 15? He says, God is totally not obvious at all. He's invisible. And in the Bible, not to see God is not to know God. John 1:18, no one has ever seen God, but God the Son has made him known. No one has ever seen God, but God the Son has made him known. So to see God and to know God go together. If you can't see God, you don't know God. People are ignorant of God. They don't know who God is. Whether they are the over 65 who says they're a Christian, or whether they are the atheist who says they don't believe in God, in both instances, the God they're talking about, if they don't know Christ, they don't know what they're talking about. So we think God is obvious and Christ is unknown. This is saying God is utterly unknown. Christ is obvious. He is the image. He's on show. He's the one who has been given to us to look at, to investigate, right? He's the one who showed up in time and space and said, ta-da, here I am. I am the God that everybody else just speculates about. And I think that's a game changer in evangelism, because it means that your job is not to first convince people of the existence of some kind of deity. What a waste of time, right? To convince people of the existence of some kind of deity, and then to try to squeeze Jesus into that prefabricated mold. What? That's totally the wrong way around, isn't it? According to verse 15. Christ is the image, look at him, in order to know who God is, right? So I was speaking at a university in Exeter University, actually. And there was a woman who came from Iran to the talks that I was giving all week, and I got to speak to her towards the end of the week, because she was always the one who was most keen, you know, writing notes and things. And I asked, you know, what's your story? And she said, I'm quite a new Christian. What happened was, she'd grown up in Iran, she'd grown up memorizing all the prayers in Arabic. She didn't speak Arabic, but she, you know, she was an observant, good Muslim girl. And as she grew up, her uncle, something happened to her uncle, and nobody was really allowed to speak about her uncle and what had happened to him. But quite recently in her life, he had managed to smuggle her a copy of the Gospels and just told her, read these. And so she picked up this copy of the Gospels and she started reading through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. She said she got halfway through Luke's Gospel and she realized God could not be the God of the Ayatollahs. He must be the Jesus God. And I just love that phrase. I've just been using it ever since. The Jesus God, right? Whoever else God is, he can't be the God of the Ayatollahs, right? The God of the religious authorities back in Iran, right? The God of the Quran. He can't be that. But look at Jesus. And it's so interesting that she was halfway through Luke's Gospel, because what is Jesus doing in Luke's Gospel? He's, you know, laughing, crying, eating, drinking, you know, just having fellowship with tax collectors and sinners and lambasting the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. This really interesting figure, right? Jesus, there's lots of things you can say about Jesus. Colossians, this chapter says the most important things about Jesus. But another thing you could say about Jesus is he's interesting, don't you think? And when you open up the Gospels and when you see what he's like, the idea of putting Jesus off to one side and just concerning yourself with the concept of deity, and then the idea of trying to squeeze Jesus back into that prefabricated definition of deity, I don't know, that's a fool's errand if you ask me. What if Christ has been given to us as the image of an otherwise invisible and unknowable God? So that you can say to your atheist friend or your theist friend, you can just say, I don't know, like, let's leave the God question out of it. Let's have a look at Jesus. What do you make of him? And maybe as they read through the Gospels, they'll start to make this conclusion. Okay, God is not the God of the Ayatollahs. He's not the God of my prefabricated understanding. He's got to be the Jesus God. So T.S. Eliot said, if God is not like Jesus Christ. No, it wasn't Eliot, it was Lord Byron. Lord Byron, another poet. He said, if God is not like Jesus Christ, he ought to be. Which I think is very close to being a very biblical statement. I think he should have just finished off the thought. If God is not like Jesus Christ, he ought to be. He ought to have finished that sentence by saying, and praise God, he is. God is entirely and utterly like Christ because Christ is the image of an otherwise invisible God. So Jesus introduces us to a very different kind of a God. And I think this just helps us in our conversations. Whether the person says they believe in God, whether they say they don't believe in God, let's get talking about Jesus. Ask them, which God do you believe in? Ask them, which God don't you believe in? What do you make of this Jesus character? Because he's amazing. And I think you'll find that your friends and work colleagues and your course mates, I think they will agree with you that Jesus is at least interesting, right? And if they don't yet know that much, then open up the Gospels with them. Start reading. Introduce him. I've got a little question mark there. I'm going to give you, if we've got time, I'm going to give you four question marks and four exclamation marks throughout the course of this weekend. The question marks are questions that you can ask in conversation, and the exclamation marks are sentences up your sleeve that you can maybe drop into a conversation. Here's the question mark. What gets you thinking? To give you a sense of where we're going, we're going to think about what gets you thinking, what gets you up, what gets you down, and what gets you through. Okay? What gets you thinking, what gets you up, what gets you down, what gets you through. But what gets you thinking is just asking your friend, I know you would never use this language normally, but you could ask your friend, have you ever had a religious experience? I know we don't talk about religious experiences. We're conservative evangelicals. We don't believe in experiences. But and we've got an allergic reaction to the word religious, but your friend knows what you mean, right? Your friend knows what you mean when you say, have you ever had a religious experience? Have you ever had an experience that makes you think there is something more to life than what you see, touch, taste, and feel? And who knows what that might be in your friend? Maybe it's the birth of their first child. Maybe it's the death of their parents. Maybe it was a diagnosis they had when they were a child. But who knows what it was that got them thinking about the bigger issues in life. And maybe you've got a story of your own about what got you thinking about the bigger issues in life. I was talking to a woman yesterday who ended up doing doctoral research into neuroscience and brain scans. But she just said, looking at drops of water on the window pane, age 7 years old, and realizing that the drops of water were not thinking about her. She's like, why should that be? Why do I have the consciousness and that doesn't? And why, you know, led her on a huge long journey, and she's written a book about it called Am I My Brain? It's very, very interesting. Sharon Dirks. And but it set her on a path to thinking about things. But of course, where you want to get to, where things suddenly get interesting is, yes, I had a sense that there was more to life, but when I encountered Jesus, I recognized, okay, he is the Lord behind this world. He is the one informing this world. This world is shaped according to him and his personality. And when I encountered him in the gospel, that was the real religious experience for me. But you can start slow with people. You can ask them, what gets you thinking? Have you ever had a religious experience? But where you want to get to is that exclamation mark. That's what I love about Jesus. That's what I love about Jesus. And I hope that there's a way that you can finish that sentence. You'll notice that I just put dot, dot, dot at the end, because I'm not going to finish off these sentences up your sleeve. I'm not going to give you a silver bullet to fire off into your conversation. It's got to be from the overflow of the heart that the mouth speaks. So why don't we think about it now? Why don't we think, what is it that we love about Jesus? And why don't we turn into the groups that we've just turned into? And let's pick something about Jesus. And if you could even pick an event in the Gospels that goes along with that thought, that would be even better. But maybe you don't have a favorite Jesus story. But if you did have a favorite Jesus story, maybe think about that. But I want you to think now, what is it that you love about Jesus? And I want you to encourage your neighbor with that for a couple of minutes, and then they can encourage you with what they love about Jesus for a couple of minutes, and then we'll feedback. Should we do that? Great. That's what I love about Jesus. Go. Have you all had a go? You've all had something to share, I hope. This is my favorite bit. This is my favorite bit where we can feedback to the rest of the room. What is it that we love about Jesus? What are some of the things that you've been saying?
We talk about his emotions. Crying over a red letter.
Wow. Right. Yeah. And so there's all sorts of stories you could attach to that. So did you hear he said about the emotions of Christ, you know, anger at the Pharisees and then love and compassion to the downtrodden? Loads of stories come to mind, don't they? But we were just in Matthew 23. It's fascinating, isn't it, where Jesus coins the phrase hypocrite. You know, before it just meant a masked actor, but he was really applying it in the way that we use it these days. You know, a religious hypocrite, a masked actor. He looks at the holiest people on planet Earth. He says, they're acting, a lot of them. Whitewashed tombs, you know. brood of vipers. And then at the end of the chapter, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who stone the prophets and kill those sent to you, how I've longed to gather you as a hen gathers her chicks, but you are not willing. It's like, isn't that astonishing? You know, I think we can do one or the other, can't we? There are some people who can absolutely lambast the authorities, and there are some people who can play the mother hen. Who is this Jesus who can do both and can turn on a dime just like that? And even to the very same people he's just been lambasting as well. It's not like he's just having a go at the religious authorities and then he's quite nice to some little children who are around him. It's like, to them, he says, I'm a mother hen to you with my arms wide open. Come take shelter. Who is that? Gotta love Jesus. What else? What else do we love?
You were saying understands the world. Understands how the world is what it is. And you say how you say the rebel what is the self of
Yeah.
The world doesn't think the questions like where we come from, where are we going, why are we here, like really hard questions.
Yeah.
But like we all actually know the answers to those questions. Mm-hmm. Because Jesus says, I am the way.
Right.
And the truth and the life.
Yeah.
And so we all have a clarity and conviction and certainty about our worldview that no one else really does, and that's because of Christ.
Yeah. Yeah. And he doesn't just point to the way. He says, I am the way. Who speaks like that? You'd get sectioned in a moment, wouldn't you, if you started to say, I am the meaning of life. And yet he just says it on every page of the Gospels. Like, yeah. Amazing.
You're saying we to love the fact he's not short on ambition and that his idea is to go from one man that uses a bunch of disciples through to, we're talking about the end of Revelation where you've got the whole universe redeemed and a countless bunch of people all singing the same song, and Jesus achieves all that, and then we get caught up in that story. So the sort of mustard seed growing into the big tree,
right?
We're part of that.
Yeah. Isn't it astonishing to think that this unschooled rabbi, born in Bethlehem and then grew up in this backwater of a long dead, you know, Israel under the thumb of Rome, with absolutely no power behind him, not two pennies to rub together, and he says, yeah, my kingdom will be like this seed that will grow into the largest tree, and even the birds will perch in its branches. Heck of a prophecy to come true, isn't it? Like, considering the context, like, there he is, this Galilean carpenter, and he's like, I'm a king of a kingdom that will grow to fill the world. Turns out he was right. Like, makes you think, doesn't it? And who speaks like that? Like in Matthew 16, he's like, you know, Peter confesses him Christ, and you know, you are the rock, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. You know, like, advance, gates are just there. He thinks his church, built on the confession that Jesus is the Christ, is going to take over the world. It's going to take over hell. It's going to raid. It's going to plunder the devil's kingdom. Who does he think he is? Astonishing, astonishing.
We spoke about his love, his indiscriminate, unconditional love when we're completely useless sinners that took him to the cross. Took it because he knew what was coming beyond after the cross.
Mm-hmm. What would we think about as a story to attach to that? Is there a gospel story?
We spoke about going to the cross, but also the woman, the Gentile woman who talks about the crumbs under the table.
Wow. Yeah. It's an interesting one. Yeah. Kind of all of them, isn't it? Yeah. Amazing.
Thank you.
Which is an interesting combination with he's the meaning of life as well. Like, the meaning of life has shown up in history and can be examined as a person. That's really attractive, isn't it? The meaning of life is actually a walking, talking person who you can get to know. And he's left footprints on planet Earth. And here's Luke's gospel, and let's get into it. Yeah, great. A couple more?
Yes.
And the authority with which he does it, that's what people are stunned by, isn't it? With a word, evil flees. Yeah, he's just this walking, talking pool of paradise, this Garden of Eden walking around and conquering the darkness around him just with a word. And
wow. Wow.
It's not all about these characteristics, then there when you walk the earth, but actually there at the beginning of creation.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if Colossians 1 is to be believed, and I believe that it is, you know, he is the creator of all things. And, yeah, if we can drop into conversation, that kind of stuff. You know, I mean, my four-year-old does it just very naturally. You know, she had a scratch last night, and the scratch is healed. And she said, isn't Jesus clever to make our bodies like that? You know, it's just like, it's just obvious for a four-year-old. It's Jesus that does that. It's Jesus who's in charge of the world, you know.
One more? Go on.
Just the paradox of Jesus being the king and yet the most humble, serving others.
Yeah.
You know, the night before he dies, and he knows he's going to die, you would think there's other things on his mind, and someone's forgotten to wash the feet of the disciples. It's the lowest slave's job. No, never mind, the Son of God will do it. Just, astonishing that he would stoop to the smelly feet of his disciples in order to cleanse them and then rise up back to the table. And of course, that's a great parable of what he's come to do, to stoop and serve and suffer and bleed and die, to cleanse us and rise up back to the place where he was. Don't you just love Jesus? And I'm always just slipping that in my evangelism. You know, don't you just love Jesus? Go on. Say yes. Say yes. Don't you just love Jesus? You know what we've just done? We've just evangelized one another, haven't we? We often draw a thick black line between evangelism and discipleship, don't we? And evangelism is us screwing up our stomach muscles and going out and giving someone a prepackaged sort of gospel outline, like 3-2-1 or something. And that's evangelism. And discipleship is this other stuff that we do. We sort of fine-tune our walk with Jesus and make sure our spiritual disciplines are, you know, up to standard. But no, it's all just gospeling one another, isn't it? We gospel one another. We share Jesus with one another. And isn't it a travesty when you go on a Saturday morning to the shopping precinct and you're sharing Jesus with people who have no love for Jesus, and then you go to church on a Sunday morning and you talk about the weather and the football and the cricket. We're meant to be evangelizing one another all the time, and then we flow out into the world. That's the way it's meant to happen. And did you enjoy that process of talking about Jesus? It's quite good, isn't it? And I'm not sure which feeds your faith more, whether you putting words to your love of Jesus, whether that feeds you more, or whether hearing about Jesus from somebody else, whether that feeds you more. Both are quite good, aren't they? Both have their place. Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote a little book on why we do church. It's called Life Together. And very early on in the book, he says the reason why we gather together as church, he said, is the Christ in the word of a brother is stronger than the Christ I nurse in my own heart. The Christ in the word of a brother is stronger. I mean, he said, the Christ in the word of a brother is stronger than the Christ in my own heart. And what he meant was the Christ that I nurture within my own heart. But when someone tells you, Glenn, Christ loves you and gave himself for you, like, oh, that's more powerful than me just telling it to myself. And we were made that way. We were made to be creatures in community with one another, telling each other that. So let's be evangelizing one another with "That's What I Love About Jesus." And then, hopefully, it becomes a lot more natural when you go out into the world and say, "That's what I love about Jesus." And then you get to see that the problems that we all have within the church are answered by Jesus. Someone is going through suffering, someone has a decision to make, some moral failure, whatever. What your friend needs in church is to hear about Jesus. They need to have the good shepherd pastor their hearts. But that pastoral care is basically evangelism, isn't it? You're evangelizing a Christian when you're pastoring them, aren't you? You're evangelizing a Christian. Pastoral care is evangelizing Christians, okay? And evangelism, beyond the church, is pastoring non-Christians, right? Evangelism is pastoring non-Christians. And the number one thing this non-Christian needs is that they don't know the good shepherd, right? And they are lost. They, like sheep, have gone astray, and you have the good shepherd to tell them about. And so the way you pastor them is by saying, "That's what I love about Jesus," pointing them to Jesus. We often draw these thick black lines between discipleship and evangelism, or pastoral care and evangelism. And I kind of think evangelism is pastoring Christians. Is that right? No, pastoral care is evangelizing Christians. And then out into the world, evangelism is pastoring non-Christians. And if you know how Jesus has gotten you through life, then you'll know how Jesus can get your friend through life. But of course, they'll need to know Jesus. That's the first thing they need to sort out. What should we do? Should we leave it there for now? And then we'll get into... Let me tell you where we're going to go. From there, everything begins with Jesus. And then what we're going to do in the future sessions, we're going to say, "Okay, Jesus, tell me, who is God? What is the world, and who am I?" Right? Once we come to Jesus and we let him be the image of the invisible God, then we ask, "Okay, Jesus, what is God like? Jesus, what is the world like? Jesus, what am I like?" And then we're going to learn that there is a threeness to God, there is a two-ness to the world, and there's a oneness to you and me. And if you don't understand the numbers, that's what the future sessions are about. Shall I pray for us? Or Sam, are you going to pray for us? I'll pray for us. Lord Jesus, we praise you that you are Lord, the firstborn over all creation, the creator, the heir, the sustainer, the meaning of all reality. And we pray that you would open our eyes to see your grace and your glory, that our hearts might be ever more full of you, and that we might overflow to our friends and neighbors. In your name, Jesus. Amen.